Well, in this show, I'm going to talk to Jamie Kilstein about being canceled and cancel culture and comedy and redemption. Very good conversation. Jennifer Cohen, fitness and financial expert, is going to join us as well. We'll do that right after this.
Hey, Friday Night Lights fans. It's Not Only Football, Friday Night Lights and Beyond is an episode-by-episode discussion of the hit TV series Friday Night Lights, hosted by yours truly, Scott Porter, who played Jason Street on the show, and my two wonderful co-hosts.
Me, Zach Guilford, a.k.a. Matt Saracen.
And me, Mae Whitman, a.k.a. someone who wasn't on the show, but really, really loves it a lot.
We will also bring on some special guests, answer your questions, and tell you about what's going on in our lives today.
It's Not Only Football, Friday Night Lights and Beyond, coming soon wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose!
From Corolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is The Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, comedian Jamie Kilstein, fitness expert Jennifer Cohen, and we'll talk Alec Baldwin with Mark Garagus. And now, Brillo head and shoulders above the rest, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. A choice, we're going to mandate you. Get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you. Good to see you, Jamie Kilstein.
Hey, friend.
And Chris Max Padham.
Hey, guys.
Man, I just had a bizarre moment that could be the reason why we're in a lot of trouble these days as a world and as a country, because I was reading down Jamie's bio. Jamie's a comedian. He's a podcaster. He's rebranded himself as an ex-male feminist, and we'll get into all the trials and tribulations. I know you did Dr. Drew's show.
I did.
Dr. Drew was like, Jamie's awesome. You need to talk to him. So here we are. A weird phenomenon that I just had is I was looking down and I was reading your bio, and I was looking at, you know, he grew up in New Jersey and he's a trained fighter, knows jiu-jitsu and all the interesting machinations of your life.
Yep.
And I looked down and there's a line at the bottom that says, Robin Williams once said, we need more comedians like him.
Yeah.
Which is sweet.
That's sweet.
But the phenomenon that just happened was as I looked at it, Chris audibly said to you, we'll be talking to Alec Baldwin.
Yep.
About Alec Baldwin, I should say, with Mark Garagus and the breaking news and the case of that. He just said the word Alec Baldwin. Yeah. As I was reading it, I read Alec Baldwin once said, you need to be a comedian. We need more comedians like you. Yeah. I read it.
Yeah.
I saw it in print. I wasn't saying it out loud. So I read it.
The letters morphed.
So then when he was done, I looked back down and I said, oh, and Robin Williams said that we need more comedians. And I thought it was a little queer that Baldwin would weigh in, but he's a pretty woke dude, and he used to be a pretty woke progressive dude.
Well, I waited post-shooting to ask for the blurb.
So I was like, and I looked down, and I kept reading the page. I was like, what happened? So when you said Alec Baldwin out loud, Robin Williams' name in print turned into Alec Baldwin in print.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In my head. And then, if I didn't recheck this and we'd gone about our way, and then I said to Chris, why'd you write on the bio that Alec Baldwin, whatever, you would say, I didn't write that. And I'd say, you goddamn liar. Yeah. I fucking read Alec Baldwin's name.
He had this whole argument in his head already.
And I'm telling you, this is going on times 330 million citizens of this state and the 7 billion of the world. This is now all going on at once, and this is why we're here.
I'm like, I don't want to 2 minutes in be preachy, but this is, you're right, this is the problem with, I mean, I used to do this, where if you spend all day on social media, you have these ingrained voices in your head, but instead of saying Alec Baldwin, they're saying blah blah blah, the Democrats are socialists, blah blah blah, all Republicans are Nazis, whatever it is, and you read everything through the lens of those voices in your head. But those voices in your head, instead of a kindly co-host, are usually the most toxic people either on the left or the most toxic people on the right. So I would never, back when I was super progressive or whatever. And even now, I call myself like a bleeding heart centrist. I'm not anti anything. I just want to just fucking be nice and tell jokes. But I wouldn't formulate, and I think this is most people, an opinion for myself, because you would see a story, and then before you even came up with an opinion, you'd be like, okay, I have to see what my team is saying. And then you'd see what everyone's saying. You're like, okay, I guess this is how we feel about it. And then I would just come up with a slightly funnier way to say it. Not really even giving a shit about the issue. I thought I was, because I was tweeting about it. And then I would just sit there and I would wait for like a celebrity to retweet it. And then I'd be like, all right, we fixed the world.
So once Baldwin hopped on that tweet, right. It would then go viral.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Then we're good.
So this then harkens to another conversation I was having with Dr. Drew earlier in the day, which is, and this is the other sort of thing, I mean, we got to keep our eye on this ball,
yeah.
Which is you need to take a tally of the amount of times you were correct, which is fine. It's important. It works. That's how society works. It works that way when you're telling your kids, you know, if they said, we want to go to Disneyland, and you go, it's going to rain on Saturday. And they go, it's not going to rain. If it's raining, you need to go in and rub it in their fucking little shitty faces and say, Daddy was right.
Yep.
For the next argument. But here's the new world order, and this is what I was talking about with Drew, which is it's very important it's more important to keep a tally of the times you're wrong.
Yep.
You have to keep that tally.
Yep.
So we're now in a place where you gather up all the times you were right, and we're only measuring wins, but it's wins and losses.
Yeah.
So it's not that as a professional football team, you had 4 wins that year and that's it. No, you had 13 losses against 4 wins, and that's how you know when you can make changes, personnel and coaches and things of that nature. And I said to Drew, it'd be a lot like you going, it's not a perfect analogy, but I think it'll work. It'd be like you going, I worked out 29 times last year. It's like, great. Now there's 333 times you didn't work out.
Right.
So you got to do both, because just going, I worked out 29 times, well, that sounds great, but it means you worked out once, you know, twice a month. Oh. We need to focus on the days you didn't work out if you want to look good in your bathing suit.
Yes, and the analogy is even worse than that, because it's the people who say they worked out 29 times and didn't work out all those other days that then will brand themselves as a fitness expert on Instagram.
Yes, yes.
Where it's like, well, I know. And I think the thing that is so upsetting about what's happening now is not only are people not taking accountability for their losses, if you change your mind on any issue, you are automatically termed like a grifter or like the idea of you evolving any of your thoughts, whether it's towards the left or towards the right, no one's encouraged to do that. So it's a bunch of people. I mean, look, how many Republicans secretly were not psyched about Trump? How many Democrats were not psyched about Biden? Say that. Be honest. You can still be a conservative and not like a thing Trump said. You can still be a liberal and not be a fan of Biden. And I think that if we had principles instead of parties, right? If you think that Donald Trump is a creep, you should probably say that Bill Clinton was a creep. If you think that drone strikes under Bush were bad, you should say that drone strikes under Obama were bad. But you are losing all fucking credibility when suddenly it's your dude in power and you go, oh, no, we're okay with that now. It's like the left being suddenly pro-censorship or, you know, anti-science, where I'm like, well, I thought those were our things.
Sorry. We have this new game that if anyone waxes on more than 30 seconds,
damn it.
We play them off with ranchero music. Watch, I'll show you how it goes. Just get preachy about any subject. Could be politics, could be COVID. It doesn't matter. We'll show you how the game is
played. That's all I've done this entire time. Okay. I think that if people started seeing each other as humans and getting off of social media, and they don't watch MSNBC and they don't watch Fox News. Oh, what's this music? And I think that really we could fix the world. Guys, we could fix the world. We could change the world if we saw each other as humans and realized that we're all trying to become really loud in my head.
All right, we get the joke. Now, listen, people, in terms of keeping a tally of when you were wrong,
yeah,
Which nobody wants to do because it feels unpleasant, but going to the dentist is unpleasant, yeah. and going to the gym can be unpleasant. There are many facets of life that are unpleasant that are good for you, and look at this as a sort of invisible version of going to the gym or yes. going to the dentist for the checkup or whatever it is. I will also say that most of the people I know that are doing pretty well and evolving nicely have a capacity for admitting when they were wrong and actually pointing it out, not for me,
right.
for them.
Yeah.
They then get growth out of it. There's a guy I admire greatly. His name is Jake, and the reason I admire him is that I met him many years ago, fresh out of Harvard, grew up sort of middle income Minnesota, made his way to Harvard and found himself to Jimmy Kimmel's writer's room.
Okay.
And I really liked the guy because he was a Harvard guy, but he was a dude from Minnesota.
Sure.
And I love a dude.
Yeah.
And we hung out and had some laughs for a couple of years. And then at some point, he announced that he was going to be a physician.
Okay.
He was going to be a medical physician. And everyone was like, we're in the writer's room on a late night show that's never going to end. So this is the best place you can be if you want to do what you thought you wanted to do when you were in college. But he said, yeah, I know, but now I'm going to give it all away and for the next 8 to 10 years study to be a physician. And I was a little dubious. I was like, I've had other friends announce yeah. they were going to do things yeah. and it never really worked out, but not Jake. Jake said, no, I'm going to do this. And he went off and he quit his writing job and he put in the 8 years or whatever he needed to put in
shit.
And became, I think an emergency medicine, the physician and actually flew in helicopters and like medevac situations as a physician. And he did it. He did all the stuff he said he was going to do. And we were watching football on Sunday. Couple of weeks ago, and he was there with a couple of the other guys. He's always welcome, and we're having a few beers watching the game. And I don't know how we stumbled into it, but he brought up Hunter Biden's laptop or
sure.
whatever. And I said, yeah, well, they knew, you know, that was a real thing, and they tried to cover it up because it was before the election. And he kind of pushed back in a sort of respectful way. Well, it came from Giuliani, so, you know, everything coming from Giuliani's got to be a little suspect.
Sure.
And I said, yeah, but the FBI had it, and those experts that all signed the letter saying it had all the earmarks of Russian collusion. And we sort of had a little back and forth, respectful. He was fine about it. I was fine about it. It was no big deal. Nobody shouted at anybody. Went on, drank beer, watched more games. And then I ran into him. I think it was at Jimmy Kimmel's 20th, but it was anniversary party or whatever. I ran into him like 2 days later.
Yeah.
And he just walked up to me and goes, I'm so sorry about arguing with you about that stuff. And I said, no, you have your opinions. That's fine. He goes, wasn't even really my opinion. I was just kind of digging in. I felt
yeah.
myself digging in. And I said, yeah, well, it's fine, Jake. You did it respectfully. And he goes, no, it's not fine. I felt myself kind of taking a position and
yeah.
circling the wagons
yeah.
and arguing with you. And I didn't really have all the information, but I didn't really care. And you were right. And I shouldn't have dug in. And I was like, that's why I like you, Jake.
Yeah.
This is why. Now we just need a little more of this. And we might be in a better place.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I'll get stuff like that will set me off sometimes too, because I mean, one, I've been in his position. I've been one of those guys who's like, what if I just like give it all up and be a cop at 40 and 5'7"? Cause now
yeah.
I teach jiu-jitsu, with Tim Kennedy. And if you've met Tim Kennedy, it's like, you're around that dude, like special forces, UFC fighter, author, like all this stuff. And you just go, oh, I just want to do that. What am I doing?
Right.
Telling fucking jokes on stage and not saving everyone's life. And then, you know, people like Tim are like, no, you tell jokes, blah, blah, blah. But I've thought about that. I've wanted to quit. But what I noticed is being around guys like that and being around people who, because even the best of comics, we're still kind of forced to be on Twitter and we're forced to read the drama and the back and forth. And even if we're trying to be more centrist or we're trying to be less toxic on social media, like we still have to be aware of what's going on. Whereas when I'm around these special forces dudes all day, I don't know how they vote. I just know they're really good dudes and they just want to help people. And that's what they do with their life. And suddenly I'll be backstage at a comedy show and someone brings up something political and I feel that just tick. just to be like, well, if we stop bombing Palestine, and people are like, what are you talking about, man? Right. And like, but it's, you argue for so long, and also you see how bad it is. And I think for Jake, he's in the real world now, just helping people, not giving a shit how people vote. So the idea that suddenly he's at a football game arguing about like the coked out son of the president, he probably, yeah, had that moment where he's like, I didn't even give a shit about that.
Yes.
Which is awesome that he, that I think there are so many more people like that. And they just feel like if you're not arguing on Twitter about shit you don't really care about, you're not doing your duty as a citizen. And in reality, I think the less we argue about that stuff and the more we just have watch football with our friends who voted differently, the better we'll be.
Well, so what is your journey? I know something about it, but you have a story of you were canceled.
It's not
essentially
good.
Yeah. I want to hear it.
I mean, the short, it's funny because when I used to do podcasts back in the day, the intro would just be like, you've seen this next guy on Conan. And now I feel like when I do a show, a lot of times the intro are like, this guy's been through quite a lot and should be dead. I mean, the short of it was when I first started comedy, or when I first started kind of getting known, I was really liberal, but I was liberal under Bush, where you're like, the war in Iraq's probably bad. And gay people, I don't care if they marry, which I think even a lot of my conservative friends now are like, the war in Iraq's bad, and like, I don't care if gay people marry. And that kind of got me labeled as this lefty comedian. I got most of my gigs overseas. Like, dude, I played the Sydney Opera House once and couldn't get booked at a New York club when I got back.
Wow.
Because they love the kind of like Bush trashing, whatever. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm in my 20s. So every newspaper, just being lazy, is like, well, this is the next Bill Hicks, because essentially I'm talking about politics, I'm talking about religion, I can't get booked in America. They go, oh, Hicks. And I grew up on Bill Hicks. Like, that's who got me to love comedy. And so I just played into it. I'm just like smoking cigarettes and fuck the establishment and all this stuff. And so we started, me and my ex started a political comedy show, like, I mean, God, it might be like 20 years ago, but like 15, 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. And this is before like The Daily Show was big. It was kind of like the first of that. I feel like now every comedy podcast is a liberal comedy podcast, but we were first. But because we had a comedy audience, it was my audience, we could call, you know, Dick Cheney a fat R word and people would be like, yeah, cool. Like, we wouldn't get canceled because it was comedy first. So we could be filthy. No one was censoring us. And then as my career kind of flatlined and my ex was a political journalist, we started to get more political people listening, and slowly it was kind of like, you can't say that. That's problematic, you know, stuff like that. So we were kind of, I feel like I was on the forefront of both cancel culture and getting canceled. Like, I was a hipster in both of those things. I got canceled before Louis did. No big deal. And so what happened was, as that show shifted, I actually went on Rogan's three times, and it's much like a TV arc where like the second season, don't watch that. Don't watch that. First was great. It was at his house. Loved each other, became friends. He started getting me into UFCs. It was awesome. Second one, I was sort of in my wokeness. And it was right when, do you remember Daniel Tosh made some like rape joke and people got mad? And I was on MSNBC. And I didn't even say we should cancel him, but I was like, I wouldn't make that rape joke. And I go on Rogan. And essentially, like, if you see those YouTube compilations where it's like Joe Rogan, the top five Joe Rogan destructions, like, I'm on there. I'm like very close to the top, where we just got into this huge fight. I didn't know we were going to fight. I think I tried not to fight, but about like rape culture and feminism. And because of the internet, you know, it wasn't even me being like, you're fucking terrible. Fuck Daniel Tosh. It was me being like, oh, man, I don't know. Like, a lot of women get raped. And like, I was also high. I don't smoke weed. But we smoked before the show. And I was like, oh, I'm on Joe Rogan's. Cause I didn't know we were going to fucking fight. And like, that should be an anti-drug commercial, is me smoking weed before Joe Rogan's. And then it says 10 minutes later. And it's just Joe at one point was standing up and he just goes, would you rather be raped or murdered? And then it just should say, don't do drugs. And
yeah, this is your mouth on drugs. They always talk about your brain, but what about your fucking mouth on drugs?
What are you saying? Yeah, it was really bad. And so then, like, my comedy career from that, I mean, I was sort of canceled twice. Like, that canceled my comedy career, where all of my heroes were like, fuck Jamie, he's a sellout. I was getting death threats because I was seen as this anti-comedy guy, because in comedy, it's like, you defend the comic.
Right.
And And again, I'm in my fucking 20s. I'm just in this political world. I don't hang out with comics, really. I mainly just hang out with, like, liberal journalists and gentrified Brooklyn.
And getting canceled wasn't a thing. So, like, having all these people.
I just go, everyone hates me.
How would you, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, someone, like, hacked my Twitter and just wrote rape all over. So I became, like, the rape guy. For being like rape is bad. And then what happened was personal stuff, depression, marriage falling apart. I have a dumb affair, shouldn't have had a dumb affair, have not had dumb affair since then, wasn't good. But because I was the feminist guy, it became the very funny hypocrite story. So, and because I was in the feminist world, a consensual 2-year affair got called sexual misconduct.
Right.
Which I've had to explain to, like, girlfriends' parents when they Google me. Like, I had an affair 10 years ago, and this is a conversation I pretty much have every day where I have to be like, hey, here's actually what happened. And, you know, I didn't want to be the anti-feminist guy. I was like, I wanted to defend myself, but I also was like suicidal. I was trending on Twitter, and I was like, I just don't want to die. And I couldn't mentally face another backlash. And so I just disappeared. I just deleted everything. I started teaching jiu-jitsu. I had a girlfriend at the time. And that was it. I went away. And then Rogan and Doug Stanhope were like, you should come back. This is probably like 5 years ago. It was the first All Things Comedy Festival, Bill Burr's like comedy festival. So Stanhope had me back on to talk about this. Then Rogan had me on that week to kind of be like, The good season of me and Rogan.
So can I encapsulate some of it this way?
Yeah.
Which is, so here's our society. If Bill O'Reilly is not warm and fuzzy, kind of known as a blowhard and a douchebag, and fine. He comes on the show. I like Bill, but that's who he is. I'm not known as warm and fuzzy either. Yeah. So if there were some allegations that the staff was disgruntled because I was mean to them, people would go, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's
who that guy is.
Sure.
But when Ellen, who comes out dancing and then talks about being kind, be kind, when we hear from one of her staffs that she was bitchy backstage, now it's a big deal.
Yeah.
So it's not really the staff and the action part.
Right.
It's who is being consistent, who's being inconsistent, and we pounce. The second we see a second of that. So Snoop Dogg can smoke pot wherever he wants, but some televangelist who's telling you about the evils of drugs, that guy gets caught with a joint.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Now, the joint's the same as it ever was.
Yep.
It's who and the hypocrisy. And we fucking pounce on that shit.
They're doing that with that guy who's like, oh, he was a drag queen in Brazil, the George Santos.
Right. So you know, we get mired in this. What we won't tolerate is rape talk or talking to your staff this way or smoking pot. No. It's who's doing it and what they said about it before. So you got the rape argument. Then you had the affair.
Right.
Now we're pouncing.
Which, by the way, I would like to say for the audience, those two things are very different. And like, if you are conflating an affair with rape culture and just being like, oh, yeah, like Jamie and Cosby. And it's like, no. Like, right. And I've had people even like friends like try to help me where they're like, hey, man, like, you know, Cosby's back, you'll be okay. I'm like, please don't put me in that category. Like, I don't want to be in that conversation at all. And, you know, what's worse is because people want to pounce so much is, I mean, the story could be, this fucking sad preachy dude is a hypocrite. He had an affair. But again, the language turned into, I mean, I was called, so there was a Jezebel article about it. I remember the girl I had an affair with, I don't know if I've said this before, or should. But the girl I had an affair with one time, I tried to break up with her because I hated it. I mean, people who think like having an affair, like, you know, they're sitting in their boring marriage and they're like, oh, that's probably hot. It is horrible. You hate yourself. And I remember I kept trying to break it off. And she goes, one day I'm going to write a, if you break up with me, I'm going to write a book about this. And I was like, I'm not famous enough for a book. And then like 6 months later, I was like, I was famous enough for a Facebook post and a Jezebel article. And so essentially she put out this call, like who's been wronged by supposed feminist Jamie Kilstein. And out of the, you know, hundreds of girls, high five everybody, that I've slept with, one girl was like, he DM'd me on Twitter and was flirty, nothing sexual. I've never sent a dick pic. I don't have that kind of confidence. And then another, this is the crazy thing. This is the crazy thing about like our press is in the Jezebel article, a girl said, you know, we hooked up. It was the safest I ever felt with someone or something like that. And then she goes, but then he called me a road fuck on his podcast. And
yes, then, I read that article.
Did you see in parentheses, it said Jezebel could not find this quote?
Yeah, right.
But they printed it. And it's like, right, because I'm not talking about slamming road pussy on my feminist podcast that I host with my wife, which is an insane thing. But the headline and my Wikipedia, like that will still say emotional abuse because I apparently called some girl a road fuck. And so to your original point, if I was just a comic, if I was just a comedian, comedians talk about affairs. They talk about fucking up. They talk about being a delinquent. They talk about trying to get better.
Yeah, Richard Pryor talked about setting himself on fire, smoking crack.
Yeah.
You know?
And we're just like, yes. But I wasn't that. And not because I thought I was better than comedy or self-righteous. It was just I was failing in comedy and I wasn't in politics. And I was like, okay, this feels like I'm doing the right thing. And then I did that. And then, you know, at the time, and I'm sure you've seen that, I'm sure you have friends and you've seen this. The only other option when that happens is not, hey, man, be a better person. You know, work on yourself. It's either this guy should never work again. Or you have to make a complete heel turn. And I even got – and I mean I haven't recovered financially still. But at the time, I'm like – I was homeless. My cat was covered in fleas. I had this moment where I go – the only offers I was getting was to be like the anti-liberal guy.
Mm-hmm.
So like if I wrote a book called – today, if I wrote a book called From Feminist to Freedom Fighter and it's like me and Andrew Tate like raising each other's hands, a billionaire. I would have, right. So I would have my own show. I'd be killing it. And those were the only offers. So it's either you never work again, haha, we won, we buried that guy. And then no one who tried to bury me even remembers who the fuck I am. They don't care because they're on to the next person. Or you have to become the like anti-version of who you used to be, which right. is why I don't like – I don't even say like anti-feminist because, yeah, I still think rape's bad. I still think bad things happen to women. I think that you should be allowed to grow – and be like, here's what I did that was wrong. Here's what I still believe. Here's where I'm at now. Here's how you bring people together. Instead of suddenly, all right, well, this group canceled me. So now I'm the fuck feminist guy. Because that's just as shitty as when I was the fuck conservative guy. I'm just yes. doing the same thing.
No, agreed. And, you know, I wish people would learn how to absorb information in a slightly more realistic way. Now, speaking of Dr. Drew... Dr. Drew can be, in his past, could be a little bit of a hysteric sometimes.
Okay.
And so, like, he would say to me stuff all the time, or he'd go, like, I was walking through the airport, and this woman came up and wanted, saw me on Loveline and started screaming. She was screaming in my face. I go, she wasn't screaming in your face. She was screaming. I go, she wasn't screaming in your face at the airport. And he'd go... All right. Well, maybe. Okay. But she wasn't screaming, but she was aggressive. And I was like, she wasn't aggressive, Drew. She was 5 foot nothing. And he'd go, but I could see him, but I was trying to tamp it down. I wasn't throwing kerosene on his hysteric fire. And I found, I always hearken back to this conversation I had with my ex-wife's friend where she was sitting around and it was fresh off of, and this is the problem. So this is the problem. So, you know, 7 years ago, Matt Damon makes this totally accurate and innocuous comment, which is there is a difference between what Al Franken did on the cargo plane with the chick in the flak vest and what Harvey Weinstein does. There is a difference, which is a very sober analysis of what the differences are between this and that. My wife's friend was getting hysterical, yelling, just shut up, Matt Damon, just shut up. And I was like... What? No, that's right. What you did is not what he did. And what he did isn't what Bill Cosby did. And what Al Franken did isn't what Cosby did. And what Cosby did isn't what Weinstein did. Hello, people. This is how societies work. It's called a nuanced thought. You may have more than one at once. Right. You can still say, I disagree with what Al Franken did, although I don't give a shit what Al Franken did. He's a comedian. He was like newer. He's probably making a joke. He's a comedian making a joke in a situation that's probably stressful and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. The real problem is all the people that have to condemn Al Franken.
thus lumping him in,
yep.
not separating what he did, at least in her eyes and her ire. And now we're going after Matt Damon.
Yeah.
And now Matt Damon has to make a comment or he's got to apologize over nothing or yeah. flee to Australia.
You're making it. I said this on Rogan's. You're making it worse for women. Yes, it's bad when you conflate Al Franken with Harvey Weinstein. Yes, it's bad when a guy gets falsely accused. I still don't think that's as bad as like all the women who get raped and don't get justice for their rape. But when you conflate those things, the reason you're making it bad for women is when you have women who have serious allegations that are real. We're so numb to it now because we go, oh, what? Is this like the fucking Aziz thing? Is this like the Al Franken thing? Right. And no one cares about it.
Yeah.
So all of this stuff, it's like it's bad. For everybody. It's bad for everyone.
Agreed. So now that brings me to something that was bothering me, which was Brian Stelter. Because he bothers me, but he only really bothers me because he is not doing what we talked about originally, which is keep track of your victories, but you also have to keep a tally of your losses yeah. as well. And I'll tell you why we need to do this, because he was at Davos and he was explaining that we need to get our hands around the truth and false narratives and all that.
He was hosting a panel called The Clear and Present Danger of Disinformation.
I'll play the clip. Now, here's the whole thing. Disinformation is not a good thing. I don't think it's nearly as dangerous as people think. If you see the food pyramid and it says you got to eat 70 servings of grain every day, right. Well, as you get fatter, then you're now, I will deputize you to do your own homework yeah. on how many servings of grain you should sure. eat every day.
I'm excited to see Adam Carolla approves of disinformation trending on Twitter tomorrow.
I'm not, and it's also, everything morphs, and there's all everything's insane. Like we said, I wrote it down here. Like 30 years ago, somebody said breakfast is the most important meal of the day, and then 10 minutes later, people were passing me in hallways, going, "You know, breakfast is the most important." And I'm like,
yeah.
I never signed off on that. I don't know who said that. It's not the most important meal of the day, and you would have been thrown into the disinformation sure. yeah. jail if sure. you piped up and said, "I don't sign off on breakfast being the most important meal of the day."
I would eat breakfast when I wasn't hungry because it was that's what I was told. Like seriously.
Also, yeah, because it's the most important meal.
You wouldn't get shadow banned on Twitter.
And how fat were you in high school?
I was the fattest kid.
Stuffing breakfast down your fat face.
I was the fattest kid in school.
I need another Pop-Tart, Mom. This is important.
This is the most important.
Put some Skippy on that Pop-Tart stat. Because it's super important. Yeah. And on the other side, and no matter how you feel about it, everyone became an expert in Ukraine 10 seconds. Like,
holy
this is
shit,
the only democracy in this region of the world, and yep. their democracy needs to be defended. Otherwise, you couldn't find Ukraine on the map 10 minutes ago, bitch, and now you're fucking got the lapel thing on. Yep. And if I go, hold on a second, maybe sending them $200 billion a day in defense, this is okay, so now we got an information situation
you're
going
on. You're a Russian spy. You and Tulsi Gabbard must be working for Putin.
Yep. So, Brian's gonna tune us up on information.
The clear and present danger of disinformation is our conversation here this afternoon. It follows a session just now about disrupting distrust. And of course, those are connected. So I hope that's where we can start. I'm Brian Stelter, formerly of CNN, now a fellow at Harvard University. Let me briefly introduce our panelists. And since we're being live streamed, a reminder that the hashtag is WEF23. We can try to put some real information out into the world to make up for all the crazy.
All right. So let me just coach up the disinformation czar over here. He was at CNN with the Russian collusion, the PP tape and the Steele dossier and everything that was completely cooked up. Now, it turns out the Russians had little, zero effect on their life. But you, Brian, and CNN were pushing this disinformation starting 2016. I mean, this shit went on for 3 years every single night. Fine. Turned out you were wrong. But then you went right to COVID. And it turns out all the shit you said about COVID for 2.5 years was wrong, two, and then you morphed into the Hunter Biden laptop thing where you were wrong and incorrect about that. And at some point, we'll see what happens with January 6th and Fauci. But what I'm saying is whatever side of the aisle you're on, I'm certainly not listening to you lecture me on disinformation.
It feels like an Andy Kaufman kind of bit where he's like, hey, what if I just host it? Like, yeah. You think everyone will call me out if I'm just like, if I'm the guy? There's no, especially with the professional pundit class, you do not get rewarded for, I remember the first time I did MSNBC, I asked advice because I was just a comedian and I was like, how do you be on these like panel shows? And the host, who I really like, was one of the more respectable people over there, was like, you do what politicians do, which is if someone asks you something that you don't know, you just pivot back to your point. So you'd go, you know, oh, we could talk about what I was wrong on CNN, but what the people really want to talk about is, you know, keeping these Planned Parenthoods open or whatever talking points are. If you watch these panelists on CNN, you'll never hear someone go, oh, I never thought of that. You'll never hear someone ask a follow-up question. And, you know, for me, I didn't get more conservative because I got canceled. I remember the moment when I was so broke, I got that book deal talk. I won't even say offer, but someone presented this book deal to me. And I literally was like, okay, well, maybe I am conservative. Maybe I'm a conservative. And this is like 6 years ago. And I remember I was just super sad. I was drinking alone in my apartment. And I Googled, I was like, all right, I heard Ben Shapiro smart. And I Googled Ben Shapiro. And then I go, yeah, nope, no, I'm not conservative. Fuck. And I closed the computer. And then what happened was I moved to Texas. And I started hanging out with conservatives. Just I do jujitsu with conservatives. I met Tim Kennedy. These people who I see being good husbands, who I see being good moms, who I see being good friends. Conservatives who, when I had nowhere to live, let me stay on their floor knowing that I was liberal. Whereas all my liberal friends, the second I wasn't an asset, I was gone, ghosted, completely fucking renditioned. And so that made me go, well, shit, if these people are really cool and I respect them as like men and women, why don't I ask them questions about, hey, like, I'm super anti-gun. Can you teach me how to use a gun? Or can you say what you think we should do? And once you could respect them as a person, suddenly you could respect their political views. Because we're so crazy in this country, we assume if you voted for Trump, you're a Nazi. If you're pro-gun, you're pro-school shooting. If you're pro-life, you hate women. Like, there are just all these crazy jumps. And so when you start to meet people who disagree with you and you go, well, they're cool, then you just ask follow-up questions. And now I go, oh, okay, well, I'm in the middle. But it had nothing to do with – and by the way, when I post something that's a little more pro-gun, people on Twitter will automatically just be like – no one applauds you going, oh, you learned something new. You asked some questions. They just go, all right, he's on that team now. Fuck him. So he can't do these shows and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think the problem is the ratio. I think on the left, they're not very tolerant to what would be a ratio. So if you're on the left and you said, well, I'm pro-choice and I'm pro-gay marriage and I want to decriminalize prostitution and marijuana but you went down the path with them on eight subjects,
yeah,
and you were simpatico, but you go, I am kind of pro-gun. I think you should be able to have a gun, and I'm down with school choice. I think you should be able to have vouchers. Right? Yeah. And I go, oh, okay, so conservative now.
Right.
And you
right.
go, no, tally them up.
Yeah.
You got 8 out of 10. It's just
that's
there's
a great
two.
Score.
There's two yeah. that I don't have. Yeah. You're at 80%.
Well, and by the way, nowadays, the two, when you said guns, I was like, you're being generous. Nowadays, you could be 9 out of 10, and it could literally be like,
oh, all you gotta do is abortion.
I don't want my kid going to a drag show.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, oh, you hate trans people.
Right.
And it's
what
like, no.
What I have found as a person who's not conservative, I have sort of libertarian thoughts that have been pushed into
yeah.
some sort of conservative circle.
Yeah.
The conservative people I know, the Dennis Pragers or the Ben Shapiros or whatever, these are deeply like religious. These are real conservative
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
They understand I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
And they understand that I like to smoke some pot and drink and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Right.
They don't have any thoughts. They don't try to turn me around. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why I don't get invited to the party. They're just more tolerant of that diversity of opinion.
The best manager I ever had, this is when I was very atheist. I mean, I opened for Christopher Hitchens.
Wow.
And like Richard Dawkins, like back in the day, like that atheist. I found out recently, and I forgot this, she's a really deep Christian and was just like completely down with me. With that said, when I tell my friends now that like I'm Christian, a lot of my liberal friends are just like, oh, so welcome to, you're in the cult now.
Right.
And they're so fucking mean. And it's wild because one of the things that I thought about liberals and one of the things that attracted me about liberals, again, under the Bush administration, I thought we were the party of like tolerance. I thought we were all about being inclusive, right? It's like, don't be fucking racist. Gay people are cool, blah, blah, blah. And now you see, I am just shocked that the most open-minded, accepting people I know are conservative Christians that I spent my entire life being like, fuck you, bigot. And now they're still just like, hey, man, come on, you're fine. Whereas the liberals have become the sort of get out. Where, and also, if you care about a political issue, you should want as many people in the fold as possible. You should want, I go on Glenn Beck a lot now, and you should want me to go on Glenn Beck as someone who is more liberal because I get my message out to millions of people just to be nice to each other and blah, blah, blah. And instead, it's like, if you go on that show, if I go on this show even, it's like, oh, so you're a fucking right-wing guy. And it's like, man, I guess. I don't know. I'd rather hang out with them at this point.
I'm wondering, like, how much of it is projection. I'm starting to think that most everything is projection.
Well, that's what I used to do.
In life. And I did kind of learn it early with a lot of, like, sort of weird – in the 70s, I'm older than you guys, but there was a lot of like sort of hippie rage, which is like, it was like you, back to Ellen dancing.
Yeah.
You know, the image of themselves, literally the image, and it's been captured on film and stuff, is there's a National Guardsman standing there holding a rifle in full uniform and they're putting a daisy down the barrel. That's
beautiful.
In their head, it's called flower power. You know what I mean? Let's get a VW van and put a huge peace sign on the hood and daisies on the side of it. Meanwhile, you push one button on them and they're fucking rageful maniacs in a second. They will fucking – they'll go full Great Santini on your ass in 0 to 60 in 2.7 seconds. Like you would piss them off and they would fly into a rage like immediately.
Gremlins.
And I wonder, is it all just projection? Like they always talk about tolerance and acceptance and we're so – accept. Like we are – you know, I'll give you one example. They never stop talking about tolerance and a seat at the table so all voices can be heard, women voices, women of color. Women of color must be embraced and accepted. Bring up Candace Owens' name in front of them, and they're like, that Auntie Tom should die.
Yeah, she doesn't count.
She's a black woman.
Yeah.
She's a strong black woman.
Yeah.
Don't you want – you've been begging for them to have a seat at the table. Fuck her.
Yeah.
And it's like – well, then wait a minute. How into tolerance are you?
Yep, I'm friends with Coleman Hughes. I'm friends with a couple black conservatives. And the shit they get.
They get worse than anyone white righty would ever get.
Anyone. And a lot of times it's by my old friends who were white as fuck. By the way, it's like when I hung out with all those white journalists, there were not a bunch of black people hanging out at like our like Friday get-togethers. It wasn't until I started going to jiu-jitsu that I was like, oh, all my liberal friends, it's just white people gentrifying parts of Brooklyn, essentially. But like I used to project all the time. I mean, even before politics, when I used to be in high school and I'd see people running and I'm like, oh, fuck that guy. And it's because I was fat like you, just eating Pop-Tarts, and I didn't want to run and I was miserable. And even the feminist stuff, I look back on that man and I didn't have – I feel like until this year, honestly, I didn't have like masculine role models growing up. So I became friends with girls. I fell in love very fast. Girls liked me because I was – funny and I could talk about my feelings. So like very like good traits, you know, feminine traits though. And so I think a lot of this projection against like dudes, right? Against like guys.
A toxic masculinity.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was just I felt weak. And so, well, if you feel weak, then you use what you have. Well, I'm going to be smart and funny and fuck these guys and whatever. And now, you know how many of my liberal girlfriends, if I hold the door for them, they're just like, God, thank you guys. Don't even fucking do that anymore. Because they're like scared to do anything masculine that's good. And it's like Drew and I were talking about this on my podcast, actually, where, you know, real toxic masculinity is just you being an asshole.
Right.
It's just like you're an asshole. But good masculinity and good feminine, like those are good positive things. But yeah, for me, I was totally projecting pretty much everything. And the problem was because I was on the left, I thought I was being so selfless because I'm defending other people is how I saw it. So I can't be selfish. I can't be a shitty husband. I can't be all these things because I'm defending black people or I'm defending gay people. And you feel so righteous that you're just blinded by your own shit. I mean, I've said this before, but there were times where literally my mom could be like, help me, help me. And I'm like, shut up, mom. I'm tweeting about feminism. Like, I legitimately thought I was being
she in
so,
a well or she was it just groceries?
No, I put her in a well so I could tweet. Yeah, man. And I think if a lot of people – just pause. If we could like pause Twitter for a month and all of us do like some form of like meditation or be with our kids or just put our phones down, we would probably realize that a lot of our anger and rage that we put on the internet, it's just bullshit we haven't dealt with yet.
Yeah, it was funny. I noticed sort of nerd rage. And the thing that's interesting, I mean, it's kind of lefty rage now, but it used to be like a nerd rage, which is very interesting, which is I noticed that Jimmy and I on the Man Show did a bit a million years ago where, you know, people had been camped out to see the Star Wars number 3 or whatever it is in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater for a week.
I think I remember
and we
this.
Just dressed up like Star Wars fans and we just walked, you know, an hour before they were going to open the doors. We just walked in front of everyone who had been camping out for 2 weeks and just sat down in the front of the line and said, I'm going to love the shit out of this movie. But what I noticed, like what I took away from it is these guys were rageful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like your jiu-jitsu friends would handle this a different way from Texas. You know what I mean? They wouldn't be rageful. They would take care
of
it.
They would quietly take care of it.
Right, right. And I started noticing this sort of nerd rage. And what we have wrong as a society is – we all think everything is some sort of 80s movie with the jock fraternity and the nerd fraternity.
Yeah.
The reality is the jocks are even and they're mellow.
Yeah.
They get it all out on the field or on the mat. They work it out. And they get humbled every day because if you want to play football, you want to roll jiu-jitsu, you're going to get your ass kicked 17 times a month.
Yep.
And you understand that feeling of having the guy across from you get the best of you constantly. And you work it out. And also you don't feel insecure because you understand what you can do physically. The angriest people on the planet are the nerds and the woke nerds are more angry and they've moved into positions of power now. And they're running big tech and they're running the LA Times. And they're all fucking angry. Oh, is Garagos on? I'll talk to him. He's on line one? Yeah. I'll talk to him about the Alec Baldwin trial or situation.
But first, I have a question.
Yes.
You know, I listened to your theory just... Hi, Adam.
Hi, Mark.
I listened to your theory. Have you ever listened to the Geraldo Rivera theory on Bill O'Reilly?
No, I've not heard it, but I'm ready for it.
Okay, I thought of this today because I was on a show with Geraldo, and somebody was asking Geraldo about Bill O'Reilly, and he says, the problem with Bill is highly intelligent, has a expansive kind of knowledge, but he's a big dork, and he never had a good date, and that was probably his problem. And I think that's an offshoot of your theory.
Yeah, that's basic cable of somebody should have give that guy good fucking and it would mellow him out. So, Mark, I was thinking you and Baldwin and second degree manslaughter is what they brought?
They call it involuntary manslaughter, which in New Mexico is what they call a fourth degree felony.
Now, is this a DA sort of grandstanding or is there any meat on these bones?
Well, you and I talked about this on our podcast a couple of times, and I think also on ATS. When he gave that interview to, I believe it was George Stephanopoulos on ABC, and he said, I didn't pull the trigger, and he also made the statement that he doesn't really take responsibility, even though the gun went off when it was in his hands. I think I told you at the time that if he were my client, I would have taken a baseball bat to his head, because that was, excuse the pun, he was triggering the prosecutors. The idea that he's going to, and the victims in the case, because it was a horrible, horrible accident, but it does arguably fit within the definition of involuntary manslaughter. And this is where the fight's going to come down. They've already got a plea agreement with the second armorer. So you, for those who are in the weeds on this thing, they've got an armorer who's, and Adam knows this, haven't been on the set, and actually educated me to some degree. The armorer was also apparently very inexperienced. And there is, and Adam, we also talked about this, not only was Baldwin the actor on the set, he was also the producer.
Right.
And there was all kinds of real-time evidence about him cutting corners, people quitting, saying it was unsafe. And so they and the prosecutor honed in like that today. You and I talked about this months and months ago, if not a year ago, and said, you know, there's two theories here. One is that as the producer, the other is as the actor. They went right for both of them, and they're going to make that argument. And it does not have to be intentional. They don't have to show that he had the intent. That's what separates a voluntary manslaughter from an involuntary. Involuntary is, did he do either a lawful act in a way that was negligent? And that would appear to be the theory under the code section, that the lawful act was he was on a movie set, but he was negligent. Was the negligence because they were cutting corners and they were shooting, or they were allowing live rounds to be shot on the set? And maybe the day before has been what some of the evidence is. There, that has not stopped, by the way, his lawyer from coming out today and saying, we're going to win. And rather some extreme bravado. And remember, Alec Baldwin could probably find it there. I don't know who's producing you today, but he's made statements that he was told before they weren't going to file on him.
Yeah, and so he did that
out of harm's way.
He did that with George Stephanopoulos. In the interview, he said, I've been told by people who are in the know that it's highly unlikely that I'll be charged with anything criminally. Oh. And then also, Baldwin and Rust Movie Productions in October reached a settlement with Hutchinson, with Hutchins' family. But the DA right after that said, this will still have no impact on the criminal charges. So I wonder, is it because he's Alec Baldwin that the DA is so adamant about this?
I think that there is a certain hubris, and I said it all along on this, which you're going to trigger DAs. First of all, when they settled and they made the widower an executive producer on the movie and had him release a statement saying this was a tragic accident, it was almost like they were too clever by half, and that's something that will normally piss off a prosecutor. Then when you say, I was told, as if your people, your manager, your agents, your lawyer is telling you that you're not going to get charged, remember, they're the ones who hold the keys to the jailhouse door, and you have to take a certain circumspect kind of position, especially pre-filing. I understand after filing saying we're going to win this, prosecutor's full of shit. I get that. But pre-filing, where they can file or not file, I always try to proceed with caution.
If this was not Alec Baldwin, would they be filing?
I think they would have filed a long time ago.
With someone, unknown actor.
If it wasn't Alec Baldwin, I'll tell you why. All of the stuff, and we talked about this in real time again, all of the stuff about the people quitting, people saying we're not going to stay there, people saying, you know, it's unsafe, real-time emails and texts, that's hard for a prosecutor to overlook.
So I was thinking about this as I was anticipating speaking to you today, Mark, and I was, you know, I like analogies. So I was thinking, if I was Baldwin's defense, I'd use this analogy. Like, let's just say, forget that it was a gun.
Let's just say we were doing Hurt Locker 2 Electric Boogaloo.
Right.
And
I'm writing that down.
And my client had to defuse a fake bomb.
Yeah.
And the process that they were going to film was he had to cut the red wire, and he did, and the bomb blew up and killed the cinematographer.
Yeah.
Would that be on him, or would it be on the person that planted the real bomb when right. there was supposed to be a fake bomb right. there? Is that analogous?
I don't think so. I think the problem here is they're going to have, first of all, they've got the assistant armorer. When he entered into a plea, that means he's already proffered. That means he's already said certain things. I don't know what he said, but I don't think they would have given him kind of the sweet deal that they gave him unless they had stuff that was going to be damning to the armorer and in turn to Baldwin. Well, so that's where I would cut off the analogy.
I think your analogy works if Baldwin wasn't the producer.
Right.
Because
right.
if you're talking about correct. Cutting corners, which is why there was right. no safety aspect, it's like, okay, now he's responsible. I think because of everything else we've talked about on the show, Baldwin should just go full pro-gun conservative, go on tour with like Kyle Rittenhouse.
Ted this Nugent. Is over.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. and just sell out stadiums.
You can pry this six-shooter from my cold, dead hand. I'm going to talk to this empty chair. Well, yeah, so I think what we're all landing on here is if Alec, pardon the pun, was a gun for hire right. who literally just showed up like it was a bad rom-com he was doing in the 90s yeah. to try to get a payday yes. with 4 days' work, or he just walked onto set.
There's a loaded gun.
And somebody just handed him a prop pistol yep. and it went off. Good luck prosecuting that. Yeah. But what yeah. we're going to get him for is not the actor's hat, but the producer's hat.
Thank you.
We are going to indict Alec Baldwin, the producer, not the actor. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's their backup. That's their default.
Right. So if the production wasn't such a shit show and all this stuff happened, would it be a different story right now?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that Adam and I talked about this, I don't know, 10 months ago, because I kept saying that all of the stuff that would give me great pause as a defense lawyer is all of this cutting corners, all of this hiring an inexperienced armorer to save money. I mean, that's the kind of stuff prosecutors will grab and run with.
How much of this also, because I grafted onto every societal exchange and situation now is sort of optics. Baldwin, sort of rich white guy, right. shoots young woman. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. if he'd shot some, you know, some old grizzled grip or something.
An older white guy.
Yeah.
He did shoot an older white guy. The director
well,
shot.
Yeah.
But he didn't file charges, by the way.
We have an attractive younger woman yeah. being shot. The armor, I think, was a younger woman, yes. too.
Yeah.
Is there optics that play
yeah,
in?
Yeah, he shot someone with like a Make America Great hat.
Right.
Like, well,
yeah. Smoking a cigar.
Accidents happen.
Yeah, yeah. That guy was grabbing the ass of every intern. Yeah, no, we're glad he's gone.
Does that play into this stuff, Mark?
You know, I could be a cynic and say if you saw one of the interviews I did today with the prosecutors, it would fit into your narrative. I'll just leave it at that.
Sure.
Mark, always glad you find time to carve out and spend with us. Reasonable Doubt, you should listen to, and Beyond a Reasonable Doubt as well. And Mark's got a whole bunch of restaurants and hotels and stuff, too.
Hey, Mark, can you get a Jezebel article pulled from the internet? All right, I'll take that as a no.
Thanks, guys.
Great to talk to you, buddy.
Good to talk to Mark. You.
All right. Why don't we do a quick news story before we get into
Jennifer
Cohen?
All right,
we
want to move on to the Alec stuff.
Let's move on.
Oh, here,
on
let's talk
stuff.
About this. So there's a hockey game on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Philly Flyers versus the Ducks, and there's a player, a Russian player named Ivan Provorov. Mm. And 26 years old. So it was Pride Day. So the Phillies were wearing their Pride-themed jerseys, had their sticks wrapped in rainbow tape. But Provorov, it's against his religion to celebrate pride. Mm-hmm. So he sat out the warm-ups, and but he's now been labeled homophobic. His quote is, my choice is to stay true to myself and my religion. That's all I'm going to say. And I respect everyone and everybody else's choices, but I just can't participate. So this is a big deal right now that he said his teammates have his back, his coach has his back. But, online, analysts, the NHL, they're all making sure that, hey, no, we're still supporting Pride, LGBTQ+.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this –
This
it's,
just,
it's a big deal. It's a big deal for
well,
for
or
the
it's nothing. Everyone's making a big deal. I love all the 53-year-old hockey analysts that never mentioned a word about this. Are out disgusted.
Yeah.
Just have such strong feelings about something. They give two. These guys growing up playing hockey in Quebec.
Yeah.
Use the word fag 700,000 times before their ninth birthday. And now they are incensed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is EJ Hradek on the NHL Network last night.
And Ivan Provorov can get on a plane any day he wants and go back to a place where he feels more comfortable, take less money, and get on with his life that way. If it's that problematic for him. And he's been in North America for a long time. He played in the Western Hockey League. He's now been in Philadelphia for many years. If this is that much of a problem for him to maybe assimilate into his group of teammates and in the community and here in this country, that's okay. Listen, you can feel any way you want. But the beauty is, if it bothers you that much, there's always a chance to leave. Go back where you feel more comfortable. I understand there's a conflict of sorts going on over there. Maybe get involved.
Jeez. All right, shut the fuck up, blowhard.
Is that a go back where you came from? Like,
yes.
Come on again.
It was literally go die in a war is what he just said. What's so crazy about that is old progressive Jamie was like, I don't know how I feel about this story.
I want to hear
both
sides.
So conflicted. But hearing that, I just go, this is why the liberals are losing everything.
Yes.
Because I'm a straight Christian and love gay people and would, if I saw a gay person being bullied, I would step in a fucking heartbeat. I have no thoughts on, if someone's going to go to hell, all that stuff. I'm like, Jesus was cool. Jesus loved everyone. That's my Christianity. All done. With that said, one, you don't want to force a guy to, I think so much of liberalism in America is performative.
Yes.
Where it's like, this dude's not going to change his view on gay people by wrapping up his hockey stick in a stupid fucking rainbow thing. So it's like, it's going to be inauthentic. But also, like, where I'm at when it comes to what I believe in right now is I just want to be a good example. And if there's a dude who doesn't like gay people, who, let's say, goes...
Dawson, get ready with the ranchero music.
No. He paused. Going. We have keep to start going. It again. We have to start clock. Again since
tell
Adam...
Tell me...
So I'm damn it.
How open your heart is again?
It's very open. What you have to do is be a good fucking example. If you're going to say, kick this guy out of the country, you think that's going to make him like gay people more? Or you think it's going to make him double down on his views and be like, fuck gay people? All that.
Got it.
You
got
to keep going. Hey, just beat it.
No, you all sit here and listen to this music.
No, here's what it is. And here's the crux of the problem was in that dickhead's sanctimonious speech, which is, if he has such a problem, he doesn't have a problem.
No.
You said, put on the gay hockey sweater, and he said, no, thank you. That's not having a problem. It's like, I don't have, if you offer me a corn dog, and I go, no, thanks, that's not me having a problem with corn dogs. That's you having a problem with me, you fucking sanctimonious prick.
Yeah.
So if it's such a big deal. Like that's the one they always are. Such a problem. Such a big deal. No, it was no deal. He said thanks, but no thanks. And then he went on and said, I'm religious and it doesn't fit with my teaching. That's a zero burger sanctimonious prick.
If he was out hate criming gay people, then okay, maybe this guy's going back to Russia. But like, he just doesn't want to put on the sweater.
Yeah. And
such a problem.
It's just like live and let live. I just want to play hockey.
Right. Yeah. Is that a problem?
Yeah.
And if that
I have standards that I'm going to stand for.
Right.
But I'm not going to throw anything in your face.
Guess who the I bitch who has all there? Yeah. Play the ranchero music for yourself, Dust. No. The person that has such a problem with it is this asshole. not the hockey player. Right. And also, yes, writing and racism in the end zone of NFL games, or wrapping your hockey stick with a gay flag. All that,
and
all
racism,
that
by the way, is all the white owners are just watching people CTE each other all day.
Right.
These like young black kids, and they're like, "Yeah, just put a fucking BLM thing. It's fine."
Well, turn the page.
I was wrong. The NHL actually put out this statement today: players are free to decide which initiatives to support, and we continue to encourage their voices and perspectives on social and cultural issues.
Also, everyone, corporations, Disney, NHL, do not fuck yourself with a handful of woke dickheads. NHL is like the most conservative viewership out there. You, by and large, 92% of the people watching agree with the Russian guy who wants to sit out the gay flag victory lap. Yeah. So understand where your fucking bread is buttered and stop buying into all the bullshit all the time. All right. Jennifer Cohen is out there. She's a fitness guru. She's an author. She's a podcaster. She's a motivational speaker. She's a financial
guru.
She's
a cold plunger, too.
She's a cold plunger, too.
So, cold plunge.
Take a quick break. We'll bring her in right after this.
January 20th and 21st, Adam Carolla and John Popper are coming to Dallas.
John Popper's a really funny guy. He could open for me, opening for him.
Hey, I've never done anything like this. It's going to be really cool.
Working Blue with Adam Carolla and John Popper. Two days in Dallas, Texas. There's a lot going on. So check out AdamCarolla.com for individual tickets and packages.
We'll do a set of your favorite songs from the 90s and beyond.
If I'm doing my job, it's your all that breaks. Because the hook brings you back.
Get individual tickets now for Adam Carolla and John Popper, Working Blue.
Well, John, if you want to do 5 minutes at the top of stand-up, it'll be
I'm willing to always do it, but, you know, just remember that you asked for it.
January 20th and 21st in Dallas, Texas.
And it really gives me an opportunity to kind of pursue stand-up, which is really what I've always wanted to do, but I was just good enough to know that I wasn't quite good enough.
Music, comedy, Popper, and Carolla.
Probably John, some vomiting.
Working Blue. Get your tickets now at AdamCarolla.com. In celebration of Jim Carolla's upcoming 92nd birthday, here's a list of 92 things Jim Carolla has never done. Number 6. Used sandpaper. Just one of 92 things Jim Carolla has never done. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
I'll be in Dallas this weekend with John Popper doing music and comedy and everything else. And Chris will be there and Dawson will be there. And we're playing music and you guys can hang out and say hi.
Blues Traveler John Popper?
Yeah.
Oh,
playing.
I was a 90s jam band kid.
All the hits.
You come out to Dallas. Come out to Dallas.
I'll drive. I'm on Austin.
Hit me up.
I'm coming. All right.
So go to AdamCarolla.com for all the info. But that's happening as you hear this. Jennifer Cohen's in studio. Good to see you, my dear.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
There's a book called Bigger, Better, Bolder, Live the Life You Want. And this part I like. Not the life you get.
Yes.
Because I think there's way too much talk about this person was born into X, Y, and Z. Yeah, everybody, almost all the time. So let's figure out how to fix it, not complain about where you were born.
That's the motto, right? You can't really, the whole purpose of this whole thing is not for people to take and acquiesce to the life that they were given, but basically curate and design the life that they really want.
And how does that process work practically?
Well, my whole message philosophy is about being bold. I think that being bold is really the through line for success. And that can be in any kind of success. It could be professionally, personally, or whatever you're trying to like acquire or get in life, right? Like it's not about People rely too much on talent, that you have to be talented and beautiful and smart, when really the truth of the matter is being bold is the secret sauce, and it's not all those other things.
Thank God.
Jeez. I always think of Brian Grazer when I talk about these types of people because I've interviewed him, and I don't know what his talent is being bold.
Mm. Right.
I don't know that his talent is acting, writing, directing, or doing anything else. His talent is walking into people's offices when he's 22 and a half going, I got good news for you. I got a plan. Like, yeah. His,
like Rick Rubin.
Right. Like, same thing. There's so many examples of super successful people. I don't want to take anything away from Grazer, but I don't think he tells. I don't think he writes. I don't know what he does.
Well, that's the whole point.
Ron Howard, if you're listening, fucking cut that dead weight now. You guys have been splitting a paycheck
fuck
for 40
that bold
years.
Motherfucker.
I'm saying he just makes shit happen. He doesn't, he's not tall. He's not good looking. He's not an actor. His hygiene is for shit. He's a racist. He's homophobic. He's xenophobic.
Yeah. Somewhere Brian Grazer's listening to this, which is a tear falling out his eye.
No, he's bold. He just does stuff. He has chutzpah.
He's got a lot of chutzpah, and that's the Yiddish Jewish word for being bold, basically. But right. You know, this is for more than just Jews, I guess. So that's why I say bold, because the truth, like you said, Brian Grazer is, and that's your person. I'm not saying anything about you, Brian Grazer.
She's like, I still want to work for Brian Grazer.
I don't want to like ruin my chances there. Yeah. But I definitely would say that there's a million examples of people that weren't extraordinary in any means, but they were the ones who went for it. They were the ones who just went and figured it out as they went, or just simply was a squeaky wheel that mm-hmm. never gave up. And that is like honestly the crux of everything, right? Because if you really think about it, a lot of people who are the most extraordinarily talented really could have never really amounted to much because they didn't put in the work, the persistence, the tenacity, and they didn't have the confidence and kind of courage just to go and ask for what they actually wanted.
Yeah, but so then the question is how do we graft that mm-hmm. on to people? How does that work?
So thank you. How it works is this is the first part of it, right? People assume that you have to be born bold or you're not. And that's simply not the case. You can acquire boldness and you could become bold by practicing. So I think boldness is a skill like anything else. Like if you want to learn karate, if you want to be good at tennis, Spanish, whatever it is, you have to practice and harness and hone it and you get better over time. And that's the way I think about boldness. It's the same thing. If you want to get good at being bold, you got to do little bold moves daily and eventually they accumulate and compound over time and then you can become more bold. Like if you're not comfortable asking for a big thing, like if you're not comfortable asking for a little thing, I should say, you're never going to be comfortable asking for a big thing.
Oh, this is me when I got a wrong order at a restaurant. I'm like, it's fine.
So that's the example I always use. Did you read my book?
Yes.
You all read it a few times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Book club.
And then you had a book.
Yeah. I asked for onion rings and you give me fries.
Yeah.
You'll never see me again. I'll never double back.
Well, you're bold. Aren't you bold?
No, I'm not.
You're not bold?
No, I'm not bold at all. Yeah, at restaurants. I'll just take
so the interesting thing is you could be bold in some areas of your life and then really timid and meek in other areas. That's a whole other area.
That's me.
But
I don't know. I'm not really bold in any facets of my life. I just realistically I've assessed what I can do and what I can't do. And if I've decided I can do something, then I'm bold. But it's not because I'm bold. It's like I used to teach boxing. I would assess how drunk the guy was and how skinny his ass was mm-hmm. and all that, and then I would beat him up
right.
if he bugged me.
Right.
But it wasn't really bold. It was as I had a skill set and he was drunk.
Okay, well, right. Listen, but I will say this. You were self-aware enough to know at some point what you're really good at and what you're weak at, and then you leaned really deep and into the strengths, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the word bold is we look at it like, you know, you try to tell people who about their diet. Fat it's got the word fat in it, but it's not a bad thing. You should get high fat yogurt.
Yes.
It's better than the skim yogurt, whatever.
Fat, yeah.
So, but maybe bold has a kind of connotation to it that like, totally. I'm not up for bold. I don't do bold. Right. Maybe there's another version of bold that isn't as bold.
Well, so that's right. So the thing is there could be this this negative connotation that it's like you're being too, you're too assertive, you're too pushy, you're too aggressive.
Yeah, bullheadish.
Right. And the reality, that's not what it is. It's about really two things. It could be standing up for what you want versus just the acquiescing and the life of good enough, right? I'm going to use you as an example, okay, just because I'm sitting here with you, right? So you leaned into what you were good at. You didn't just kind of, you took a career path that's not very easy, right? Like that's a very difficult career path to take. You became successful at it, but you took that chance versus doing, you know, well, you know, my cousin has a job in marketing at this X company, and I'll just do that. My idea is to make people and give people, empower people to give them the courage to do something tomorrow that they didn't have the courage to do yesterday by giving them this blueprint of how to become more bold or how to become more assertive, whatever the negative connotation is, who cares really? Mm-hmm. It's about the action of what it is and what it means and it implies.
Are you a fan of the fake it till you make it?
I'm not really
let's say you have a comedy career and like something happened in the middle of it that we don't need to talk about and you're reestablishing yourself. Do you kind of pep talk yourself where you're like, I'm good enough?
So there's a big thing. Like, I'm not a big person in like manifestation and visualization. I'm not woo woo.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm more about, if you want to visualize and manifest, that's good. I'm not discouraging that. But at the end of the day, all that just stay dreams unless you execute and unless you actually do something about it. You can't just rest on laurels and think because I want it and I visualize it, it's going to happen. So I'm about putting in the work, first of all, and gaining the confidence to believe that you are something versus just, I believe I am because, you know, I'm good enough. Well, you know, like maybe you are good enough, but that's okay. That shouldn't stop you from going after it. You don't have to be good enough and that's okay. But you will, whatever it is, something in motion stays in motion. And if you just, that's like, it's like inertia, right? Like something stagnant stays stagnant. So this is an act of being, going in action, practicing, and doing versus just sitting back and just taking whatever comes to you.
You know, it's weird. Bold has a pretty high batting average, and yet many people don't engage in it often, which is there's so many times when we talked about this on the podcast maybe a week ago, where like I'm with somebody and we're checking out of the hotel and they go, you know, they'll have some beef, like the mini bar fridge didn't work and the curtains were kind of jamming. And I'm going to go up there and I'm going to tell them they better knock $50 off the price of this bill. And I'm like, don't come on. We'll get into trouble. And then I'm like, no, I'm going to go tell them. And I'll go, okay, you go over there. I'm going to go get in a fetal position in another part of the lobby. I'll be under the ficus plant over there in the
corner.
Call
my burner phone.
Right. And they just walk up and blah, blah, blah. And then they'll turn around and they'll walk toward you and you go, oh, that's good. They knocked $50 off. I've had that, you know, or like, I'm going to tell them they better comp this salad because they fucked up the salad dressing like two times. Like, don't get into trouble. We'll get into trouble. And then they comp the salad. Like, I know bold works. Bold has a strong batting average. I've seen it work. I've seen guys go, I'm going to talk to that girl at the party. He's like, don't do it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, next thing you know, he's getting a blowjob in the bathroom.
Yeah. Still under the fight history.
It worked. It's worked a million times, but it's still, I feel apprehensive. Like, I don't want to do it.
To some people, for sure. And that's the idea. It's that you don't know unless you try. And so you don't know what you don't know. I had a guy and a girl both say to me, they like read the book and they like tried this thing and for a couple of weeks. It's only been out for a couple of weeks. And it was actually someone who had like an advanced copy. So they did it for like a month actually. And they went around and everywhere they went, they asked for a 10% discount or a discount wherever they went.
Yeah.
Any restaurant.
That's going to help the cause that you choose. Your stock has never been higher. Kanye's going to love this.
They saved
These Yeezys at a significant discount. Kanye, sorry, go ahead. They didn't have a Jewish last name.
No, they did not. Okay. Thank God. Okay. I wouldn't be telling the story.
Yeah, the O'Reillys could try that.
Only the Catholics do this drill, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did it work?
They saved thousands of dollars because it's like the audacity, first of all, right? Like even asking the question. But all these places had these like local discounts that nobody even heard of or knew of because they never bothered to ask. Mm-hmm. So it's like, why not ask? Like, what's the worst that could happen? You're not any worse off now than you were a second ago by the ask, right? Like, you never know. And if it's not what you say, it's how you say it. So, like, you might be hiding, you know, behind the ficus tree or plant. But, like, if your friend was asking in a nice, polite way, no one really cares. It's if you're an asshole about it, right?
Yeah.
And
Well, the thing that's interesting, and I never really thought about it, is when you approach the person who's behind the desk and you're checking out at the hotel and you go, you know, the mini fridge didn't work and the curtains were kind of jammed and we'd like a little discount on the room rate as we're checking out here. Once you go bold with that, you now force them to go bold back if they will. So now the bold ball has been volleyed over the net into their side of the court because now that person has to go, yeah, we'll knock off $50, or they'll go, you should have said that the fridge wasn't working when you found out it wasn't working. And so now you're putting – you going bold is forcing the other person to make a bold move back. Otherwise, you are going to get your $50 off.
Unless they – listen, I'm hoping that they never read the book, right? So maybe only that one person who asked for the $50 read my book.
Statistically, it's a coin toss.
Yeah,
I went to every single hotel in America and asked if they read the book. Probably statistically, even Michelle Obama's book, they probably statistically wouldn't have read.
I agree with you. I was teasing
though she's
you anyway.
Moved many units, but yeah.
Many units. Same with like, also Spare. But anyway, that's we digress.
Well, and I think what you were saying before about being a lot of people associate being bold with being an asshole, and so then they just are weak. Like, there's a difference between just bullying a low-paged Holiday Inn desk worker by being like, hey, man, the fridge wasn't working. I know it's not your fault. I'm not trying to be a jerk. Is there anything we can do? And then you walk away with a free breakfast. That's a bold move. And then that's a rep to make.
And that's a rep. So that's basically reps. That's what I'm talking about. And what you just said is basically what I was saying earlier was if you're doing it in a nice way and it's not you're not being an asshole about it. Like
I just didn't want this audience to start just harassing the hotel employees.
That's what it's about. But it's not like these are all reps that we're talking about, like asking for the $50 off, asking for the dressing on the side or whatever you are, whatever it is at the restaurant. But these are reps that you need. Like those are like 2 pound weights. Yeah. So how are you going to go to a 100 pound weight if you're not even comfortable doing a 2 pounder? Right. You got to like work your way up.
I have a friend who's so bold. I'm a bold friend. he bought a bunch of porn at the hotel back when you would buy porn at 13 bucks a pop, ran up a bill for like $80 and just said,
no,
not paying for it. And she's like, sir, at 2 a.m., you got your Bangus Uranus 13 on here. You watch it then the following morning. It's like, never did, not paying for it. They're like, oh, don't even bringing it up.
They're like, that's Mr. Funny. Grazer.
All right.
Poor Mr. Grazer.
Shall we jump in and do some news stories? And Jennifer, you can see whether some of these stories are bold.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Or not.
I have a rating card here, 1 to 10.
Oh, man.
Well, I got a story. This is with Marie Osmond. So she...
You want to know how bold this guy was?
The porn guy?
I do. Absolutely.
I want every story about this
Me
man.
Me too.
We went... when we were doing the man show, we went to Crazy Girls or Girls That Hate Their Dads or something. There should be a club. I would hang out at that club. And
Daddy Issues,
right. And we just went there just to drink and get lap dances. But we would then bill the production and say we were on a scout.
Right. Yeah, it's a write-off.
That's a big bold move.
Chicks on trampolines. And... The production company went, listen, we'll pay your $1,700 tab of you guys out drinking and getting lap dances and coming back with no talent. You came back with a boner. You didn't come back with talent. And they said, look, we will pay this time.
This one, this is the last time we're paying. You cannot go out and rack up $2,000 bills at strip clubs and it to come out of the production. And this guy, who's very bald, he looked at me and Jim and he went, "This is bullshit. We're going to march right into their office right now. And we're going to tell them how." And I'm like, Jimmy and I are like, we are not going into their office incensed. No. And by the way, like offended that you said this is the last time we can spend $1,700 right. at the Seventh Vale.
Did he get it? Did he get?
He got that one paid. The second one, we're like, we're not nearly as bold as you are.
So he never
bold.
Got it paid for the next time.
I want this guy to manage me.
I don't know. We did it the next time because we're like, they're not going to pay for us going out getting drunk.
Yeah. But you never know unless you ask.
I can't breathe.
Yeah. Well, it's true. Maybe we should have fallen.
Yo, guys, let's go do it right now. Let's get out of here.
What do you got?
Oh, so Marie Osmond, 63 years old. She has opened up about her plans about not giving her kids in her inheritance. So she is totally standing by this. She kind of mentioned it a few years ago because when they were doing a story about Kirk Douglas, who left most of his multi-million-dollar fortune to charity. So Marie Osmond's like, yeah, I'm not giving my kids my money after I die. Like, I'm going to use it. I'm going to spend it. I'm going to hang out with my husband. We're going to have a good time. But they're not going to learn anything if they just get all my money. I want them to earn it. And she's standing by that.
Bravo to her.
Years after, yeah. Bold.
That's very bold. Yeah. And also, she's doing her kids a service, let me tell you.
Yeah, 7 kids, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah, so
she's got to have a crazy net worth because she's been working since she was 4 and a half.
Right.
And
totally.
She's a Mormon. So it's like a third divorce and then in and out of rehab and a fucking business manager when I was high took me for everything I had. You know what I mean? She avoids all the pitfalls. You know, blew it all in the booger sugar in the 80s or whatever. Mixa started working at 5. Like, those Osmonds didn't start working at 14. They started 5.
Yeah. So,
how much is she worth?
I'm seeing $20 million. That's off of it.
What?
Google.
No,
I know. But these sites could be wrong.
Me and Weird Al are worth $20 million.
I'm worth $20 million.
Oh yeah, one of those sites.
The idea of starting work when you're 5 and then having your little shitty like Gavin and Hunter, your kids, just like expecting that money. I don't disagree. I mean, it would be cooler, I think, if she was giving it to charity instead of being like, I'm going on more vacations.
Well, maybe she'll give the rest of it to charity. But yeah, she did. So her quote is, honestly, why would you enable your child to not try to be something.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who becomes anything if they're just handed money. To me, the greatest gift you can give your child is a passion to search out who they are inside and to work. I mean, I've done so many things from designing dolls and much more. I love trying.
I like she got her doll plug in there.
She left her website.
I've done everything from Weight Watchers to Jenny Craig commercials over my 40-year career.
That's right.
I've designed dolls.
That's right.
I know. Designing dolls.
The list was long.
Documentarian at the top. Performer. Celebrated Vegas act. Then get the designing dolls.
Again, that's how you know that's the business that's hurting. That her manager was seriously like, yo, you got to get a doll plug in
you
this.
Gotta
this
plug the dolls. Yeah. You got to plug the dolls.
We are hurting.
But she says, I think
that new movie's kicking the shit out of us. That Megan movie has fucking destroyed the domestic doll market.
We took a hit.
It's down 86% the last 3 weeks.
Everyone's scared of dolls now.
So she says, I think all inheritance does is breed the laziness and entitlement. I worked hard, and I'm going to spend it all and have fun with my husband.
Have fun.
Yeah.
Not drinking caffeine or alcohol or smoking or doing or staying up after 10. Yeah. How much fun?
You know, on one hand, I got a lot of respect for this, that she wants to spend her money in her old age. I've been trying to tell my parents, spend all your money. We don't need it. Just spend it. But what kind of assholes do your kids got to be that you're Marie Osmond and there's more than enough to go around that you're not going to just float them something?
And also,
I don't go with this.
Aren't your kids in their 30s now? Like,
and they probably do have a nice starting base.
I think what my thing is I get what she's saying in principle. I'm fine and I agree with it. I don't know where I would be if anyone did anything for me or gave me any money or gave me a job that I'd be comfortable at or something like that. I probably got all my motor through just sort of basic desperation. It wasn't character. It wasn't bravado or being brave or bold. Or, it was just like I was desperate. So I ended up working hard. So I get that part. But by the time you're sort of 17 to 25, that'll be declared. Like, you'll know the hard workers and the enthusiasts and the bold and the everything. Her kid's got to be 33. Yeah. So if one of them's a junkie, you know, by all means, don't dump off $5 million. So that guy's going to kill himself. But if you have one that's got the entrepreneurial spirit and working hard, or maybe working with special needs kids at the kindergarten level, like, go ahead and,
son, you can have my doll company.
Or at least tell them when they're 17, not when they're 33. So that they don't miss their prime working formative years.
Like, I was really banking on that inheritance.
Used to being out there.
I'm sure they're not living on the streets, though. I'm sure they're being like somewhat taken care of. But I think she means more. I would imagine. I'm not her.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Right. Like, I think it's more the fact that, like, leaving them so much padding and security where they have no work ethic and no need to strive for anything.
When did the conversation shift? Because I've had a million conversations. So, like, okay, now who's going to take care of the kids? And it's like, when they're adults, you know, who's gonna buy them groceries when they're in their 40s? It's like, who? I mean, of course I have to work hard, and then I have to give everything to them, because how are they going to take an Uber or buy groceries when they're 44? Yeah. It's like, I don't feel like my parents had those conversations about me or my sister past the age of 9 and a half. It was like, fucking get out of the house and get a job, or don't. Well, like, we don't care.
Don't you feel that, like, now there's, like, much more of a coddle culture type of idea?
Oh, my God.
Like, everyone now, there's so much more helicoptering. No one, everyone wins a participation trophy. No one's allowed to fail. No, everyone's very protected and in life.
If you were
God forbid you say anything, it's like you're shunned.
No, I think about that. If you were raised in the 90s, or let alone, God, if you had brothers and were raised in the 90s, we should all be in jail for attempted manslaughter. We should, like, the way we were raised, there, like, I remember when I used to brag and be like, oh, I have the cool mom. And then I suddenly became 40 and I was like, oh, she was just an alcoholic and, like, lighting cigarettes on the stove. And, you know, they would just send us off. And sometimes we would come home, like, me and my friends from, like, the woods, like, covered in blood. And they almost look surprised that we even made it back home. I feel like old school parenting was like, do you remember when UFC was illegal in most states?
Yes. Yeah.
And there were, like, no rules, and it was in the porn room of Blockbuster. That was that was 90s parenting. Whereas now it's on SportsCenter and ESPN. Yes. And it's a little gentrified.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know when it shifted, but I agree with Murray.
Yeah. I think Shaq said the same thing. Gordon Ramsay, his kids fly coach when he's up in first class.
That rules. Yeah. That rules, because he's on the plane in for a hit. He's like, earn it. Earn your seat next to me, son.
He probably goes back and shits up their bathroom and then walks back. Sits down on his throne.
Yeah, message.
All right, one more.
Okay, well, I saw this on CNN the other day, and we could just play the clip. It was just a throw to commercial, but I think you'd like it, Adam. It kind of, I know you. We don't play a lot of stuff that you love on CNN, but this one kind of goes up your alley here.
If you were tired of taking a lot of medications, maybe you should try a walk. There is new proof today that the great outdoors really could be the best medicine.
Yeah, so she's talking about a study out of Finland. 6,000 people in three of Finland's largest cities were interviewed at random, and they figured out that time spent outdoors, like going for a walk in the park or near a lake, were associated with lower odds of using medicines for blood pressure, anxiety, or asthma.
Yeah. You already know everything. Just grandpa knew it and grandma knew it, and, you know, all the settlers and those who came before us. I used to say to Dr. Drew in the mid or later 90s, because everyone was calling in and they're getting on Ritalin and Zoloft and shit like that. And I'd say, how about you take a hike and listen to classical music, do that for a month, and then see if you need your serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And it was always like, what do you know? Because it was a lot of like, what do you know? Because I didn't go to college. I was a carpenter.
I
was dispensing advice, like in this case, medical advice. Two cc's of D5W and lactate ringer. Stat! We're going to intubate.
I mean, everyone would just look at me and go, what the fuck do you know? And I'd go, I don't know anything. I just know that when I'm walking and I'm in nature and I'm listening to classical music, I'm in a much better space than stuck in traffic or yelling at my agent on the phone. So do more of that.
That's it.
And you'll be better.
Well, there's a lot of research, and, I mean, not like you're asking me, but I'm going to, on the fact that like exercise is probably the best antidepressant, number one.
Yeah.
And the just not even for like physical reasons, but for the mental aspect, the cognitive focus, alert, everything it does for you on the mental is just bar none better than any medication.
Yeah. And by the way, even if it's just a 10-minute walk, if it's between a 10-minute walk in nature or a half an hour angrily scrolling on Instagram or fighting about January 6th on Twitter, it's like just put your phone down and go outside.
But the thing that we need to really wrap our arms around as we're talking about, you know, young adolescent obesity and pills that can be taken for obesity, and then everyone is on some sort of SSRI or some mood altering
crazy
whatever, like everyone's doing something. No free lunches in nature, none. You must get out, you must exercise, you must be with people, you must laugh, you must hike, you must sweat, you must fall, you must fail, you must do everything. You taking pills, wiping everything down with Purell, looking for some life hack that's going to get you out of whatever your headspace you're in. There isn't. There's no free lunches, there's no shortcuts, but that's good news. This whole thing of like,
but people want shortcuts. That's the problem.
I understand it, but like, that's the problem. The problem is the wanting of the shortcut. Now, if you're using Waze and you're going to the airport, fine. I will grant you that. But I know you're a cold plunger, right?
I do all that stuff. I'm like a big sauna person. I do the cold plunge. I do all those biohackery type of things. But at the end of the day, those are all just nice additives. But you know, before this book, I wrote a ton of books on like health and fitness and diet. And the reality is, I was talking about the basics because it's not complicated stuff. It's like doing the basics, do a squat, do a lunge, go for a walk. Nobody wants to hear the obvious things that really do, that actually work, right?
Like
eat clean, don't eat McDonald's 24 times a month. But people want the magic pill. They don't want to just listen to reason.
Yes. I've been saying this for 10 years, just diet and exercise. And I'm not talking about health.
No, I know.
Or weight. I'm just saying, here's what life is. Diet and exercise. That's all. Whatever but that could mean study harder or apply yourself more or have a little more grit or fortitude or whatever. But it's just diet and exercise. You read all the books, have Marie Osmond tell you about the Weight Watcher fudge and the linguine you can have every night that comes in a weird cardboard thing. Right. Or you can just go diet and exercise. You know it. Yeah. Everyone knows it. Everyone's going to tell you something. Here's a pill. It's going to be tantalizing. Here's some low-cal fudge. Don't do it. You know what the answer is.
Common sense isn't that common, unfortunately.
Right.
And you're right. And they don't want to know. That's the bottom line. People want to look for the shortcut. And whenever a shortcut, by the way, does come into play, the reality is later on you find out that it's like cancer causing and there's terrible side effects and everything else versus just doing the walk.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, again, this is I was lucky because I think these kids are being raised on it. So that's why the entitlement has heightened because, again, being raised in the 90s. Now I'm learning. I have every learning disability. Dr. Drew on my podcast yesterday, we're talking about like I have to go to love addiction meetings, all these things. And then I just told a story that I thought was super normal. And he goes, right. So let's circle back. You were talking about OCD behavior. And I was like, oh, OK, I guess I have fucking OCD. Like I didn't even know I had OCD. But again, in the 90s, if you were any sort of slow couldn't pay attention, they were just like, all right, he's kind of retarded, and they'd put you in like the slow, like I didn't take any I didn't take any pills or anything. And I look back and I just go, thank God, man, like I got so lucky that I didn't get
so
numbed
funny.
Out early.
So I've never taken an antibiotic from like 0 to 35. Number one. Number two, it's funny you said pills because just talking to Dr. Drew about this, there became a big opioid epidemic and blah, blah, blah. But back in the day, I said, I got 1975, I was like 10, 11 years old, whatever it is. I famously got my shoulder separated in a Pop Warner football game, and it was out, and it was way out, and it was so far out, they canceled the game. They stopped the game. They called an ambulance. The dads wouldn't move me
from the field to the sideline so they could keep playing the game. They just looked at me. They cut my jersey off. They cut my shoulder pads off. And the dads all looked at me and just went, I'm not fucking getting near this kid.
Give him a
And they called the ambulance and they picked me up.
You keep score.
They took me up. They took me to the emergency room. They tried to reset it. They couldn't reset it. They sent me home. I stayed the night. I went to an orthopedic specialist. The following day, he tried to reset it. Shoulder out of socket is exquisite and excruciating pain. Excruciating. I had a high threshold for pain, and I was out of my mind in pain because my shoulder was way out of socket for the following day. Then I went to bed that night. Then the following day, I went to had to be checked into a hospital, and I had to stay that night in the hospital. Then I had to go under general anesthesia the following day and be put out completely so they could manipulate my arm back in a socket. Never got a pain pill. Now, I didn't get a motherfucking aspirin in 1975.
Wow. Holy shit.
They took me with my grotesquely out of socket shoulder and just sent my ass home. And I sat on the fucking sofa. I pissed into a Gatorade bottle because I couldn't stand up and make it to the bathroom. There was no pain medication whatsoever, which is insane. But that's how little they handed that shit out.
Yeah.
Back in the day. All right, a happy note to go out
on. Your little mangled child arm?
Yeah. Yes. All right. Jennifer Cohen, the book, Bigger, Better, Bolder, Live the Life You Want, Not the Life You Get, which I love. Jamie Kilstein, thank you. You got dates in Maui coming up at Pro Arts Playhouse.
Yeah.
That sounds good. February 9th.
Yes.
And then HB Social Club. That'll be Valentine's Day. That'll be... Oh, that's in Oahu.
Oahu, yeah. Right. So all on Hawaii. And some other dates are being posted on the site.
Nice. So go to jamiekilstein.com for that. We'll see you guys in Dallas this weekend. Until next time, this is Adam for Jennifer and Jamie and Chris saying mahalo.
Make sure you get a copy of Adam's latest book, Everything Reminds Me of Something. It's available everywhere. Finer books are sold. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and get your tickets to join us in Dallas this weekend at adamcarolla.com.